Monster Man, special episode, recurring villains. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a special episode brought to you by the generosity of my Patreon backers. And in particular, Patreon backer Andy Markham, that's Andy Action to you, stalwart of the Indian OSR RPG scenes. Andy asked a very interesting question, not about a specific type of monster, but about a specific role that a monster can play in your campaign. He said such good stuff in his email that I just want to quote it. He said, "How about an episode on recurring and evolving creatures and or the NPC monster during campaign play? Some examples to illustrate further. The Yuan Ti Sorcerer King Lich and their thralls as they plague the PCs throughout their campaign, in their dreams, in their backyards, in the jungles, and in the dungeons. The Ifriti Tyrant whose island retreat on the Prime Material Plane is being threatened by the PCs, so he sends his Salamander, Fire Elemental, and Fire Mephit minions after them in an attempt to maintain his alpha male status in his volcano fortress on what is essentially a tropical sanctuary from his outer planar enemies. The Witch Queen, who jealously hides her artifacts in dangerous dungeons, protected by monster zoos, eldritch puzzles, and sorcerous traps. She knows that powerful adventurers will seek these relics, so she places them with the intent to eventually manipulate the PCs into doing her bidding. The point being, the nemesis NPC monster figure must evolve over the span of the campaign in terms of their dynamic goals, powers, and ways they interact with the PCs. They spend much of the campaign off-screen, but still loom large over the campaign arc and have to interface with the PCs in meaningful ways without forcing the inevitable final boss battle each and every time." So, and I think there's a lot to discuss here. So before we get started, I'd just like to say that if you'd like to be like Andy and get your own special episode of Monster Man, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and subscribe at the $5 level. And if you subscribe at that level, not only will you get your own custom episode, but you'll also get access to my other show, Patron Deities, in which I talk about the Deities and Demigods book, and also the bonus content that I periodically release for all Patreon subscribers, and which I realize is currently overdue. Patron Deities is currently going through a series on Native American mythology, and although it's been very challenging to research, it's been very interesting so far, at least I think so. So, Andy, once again, thank you very much, and I hope that you enjoy this episode. Alright, to start with, I feel like Andy's mainly asking about one type of recurring villain, but there is another type that is also worth discussing. And we can think of these as the climactic antagonist, or boss monster, and the recurring antagonist. The recurring antagonist is maybe more suited to sort of sandbox play, although there are ways to fit climactic antagonists into that type of game as well. So an example of a climactic antagonist would be someone like Dracula. You're going to go through this campaign, and maybe you have lots of different encounters on the way, like, you know, oh, the mountains of Transylvania are full of wolves. And maybe there are people who are Dracula's agents, and maybe you run into Dracula before you really realize who he is. But at the very end, you can have a big fight with Dracula, and you're going to cut his head off, and that's it. That's the end of the campaign. He was the boss, and you defeated him, and now it's over. There are other examples of villains who are what we might call recurring antagonists. That is to say that they're people who inhabit the same world as the main character, and they oppose the main character, or have schemes that the main character opposes, but defeating them doesn't necessarily end the narrative. So an example of that would be a character like the Joker. Batman's gonna stop the Joker's plan to poison the reservoir, and he's gonna send the Joker to Arkham Asylum, but that's not the end for either Batman or the Joker, because there's something about their fundamental natures that puts them into a recurring conflict. In fact, later on, we may look at some of the ways in which these recurring types of antagonists can struggle when they wind up in genres that either, you know, have progressions and ends, or that aren't quite sure what genre they are. Like a lot of television programs are like that. And indeed, these days, so are many comic books. To craft these kinds of creatures in the campaign, there are a number of things that you need to take into consideration. And the first is which monster you start with. Now, I think that Andy provided several great examples. For example, one of them is a human, and humans are a great place to start because their motivations, while they may not be shared with us, we definitely feel like we can understand them, right? No matter how aberrant a human's behavior is, there's something that they have in common, not just with the player characters, but with us, the players, that we feel like they're more relatable, more comprehensible. But really, any kind of intelligent being will do. Anything where you can imagine the monster having a scheme. So You know, oozes and slimes, probably not likely to make good recurring villains. Although, I mean, you know, you could do it because it would be a twist on what you would expect. But in general, I'm thinking things like, well, it could be a lich or a vampire. It could be a powerful sorcerer of some kind. It could be a godlike being like a, you know, a djinn or an aboleth. It could indeed be, you know, an archdevil or not even an archdevil, just a regular devil. Dragons are classic, although it could be a mind flayer. It could be, I mean, it could be any number of things. It could be a whole society, although you do want to kind of put a face on that society. So an example of like an antagonistic society would be the drow, but you would definitely want to have some kind of supervillain at the helm, which, I mean, again, I'm not like knowledgeable about the canon, but I genuinely actually don't know if there is such a character in the world of the drow. I guess probably the most notable example of such a villain in published D&D works, I guess, is Strahd, right? Strahd is not just an archvillain, but his influence, his actions, and his kind of like look and feel extend throughout the setting that he operates in. The villain needs to have a goal, and sometimes that goal is just to be left alone. Again, that's a very sandboxy goal because that presumes that the player characters are, you know, going out there and not leaving things alone. But it's nice if it's a relatively broad goal, because what that means is that it gives the villain a wide range of ways to come into conflict with the player characters. So if you're designing a campaign from the ground up around this villain, then it's possible for them to have a very specific goal, like find the blue jewel. But you can also design them with a more general goal, like find the secret of immortality, and it turns out that the blue jewel is one of the ways that maybe you could become immortal. Or conquer the entire world. We could maybe divide these into two major types of goal. You could have a specific goal, kill every last member of the family prophesied to destroy me, or you could have a general philosophical goal, prove to everyone the superiority of lawful evil. This is true when designing player characters as well, and I find that philosophical goals tend to be more adaptable, right? If you're only interested in bringing to justice the man who killed your parents, then your story winds up being bounded. But if the murder of your parents gave you a burning desire to fight crime, then you can go on for, I don't know, 82 years doing that. 81 years. 1939, Batman. 1938 is Superman. You see this with villains as well, and we see in villains how specific goals can be replicable. So Mr. Freeze has a specific objective, while the Joker has more of a philosophical goal. Of course, those characters have been written by multiple authors, so they're obviously not necessarily consistent, but you get the gist. So in my post-apocalyptic campaign, for example, I have a group of antagonists whose pitch is that they want to restore order to the post-apocalyptic wasteland. And what that means is that they can be encountered in a number of different ways. The PCs have run into them sponsoring mercenaries to attack their enemies, questing for technology or items that they, you know, think might be useful to their cause, hiring the PCs to do that kind of thing, establishing diplomatic negotiations with other polities that the PCs want to prevent from succeeding. They turn up in all kinds of places because their goal is very broad and could have multiple sub-goals within it. Makes them very adaptable. A successful villain should also have some kind of organization that they head or are part of. A cult, or an army, or a gang, or even a nation. Are we talking about the villain being some kind of, you know, evil emperor or dictator, some kind of cult-leading demagogue, or is it a cult that's formed around the villain, you know, not at the villain's instigation? So if you're a dragon, you might have a cult full of dragon fanatics who worship you, and you might not even have started that yourself. You're just powerful enough that you accrete worshippers, and you send them on missions and things because, you know, that's what you do. Good organizations like this rely on strong branding. For example, Cobra from G.I. Joe has excellent branding. Maybe he goes a little too far, absolutely everything being snake-themed, except for the weird spin-off groups that are not snake-themed at all. But some kind of, whether it's a slogan or a badge or something, that links them as being connected. All of the characters from that antagonistic group in my post-apocalyptic game, for example, have the same weird accent, which is someone who's not American trying to do an American accent, the accent. It could be some kind of visual or thematic element. So, for example, you recall, in Andy's example, all the different fire monsters. So, okay, we're fighting a fire cult. Now, you have to be a little bit cautious here because there's a danger in Dungeons & Dragons that when you choose an element like that, you're going to wind up with a bunch of creatures that are ultimately kind of mechanically similar. So if you're fighting all the fire monsters and fire worshippers and fire elementals and fire this and fire that, you're going to quickly develop a bunch of ice magic and ways to put out fires. And that means that fights can ultimately become a little repetitive. But you can counter that problem, I think, in D&D is relatively easy. Particularly if you're playing an older edition with a very robust monster collection, it's very easy to find, like, even if you just decided to go through the Monster Manual, the Fiend Folio, and Monster Manual 2 and only choose fire monsters, you will wind up with monsters that were quite different from each other. Or, you know, if you only had ice monsters, you know, on the one hand, you could have, you know, yetis and winter wolves and ice elementals and so on and so forth. And then at the same time, or ice para-elementals, I guess they are. But at the same time, you could also have, like, ice cultists, and they're people who, you know, they worship, like, the metaphorical power of ice. You know, they're going to embrace the cold and, you know, cut out emotion and friendship and joy from their lives, and that's the kind of ice we're talking about. But they kill you by, like, knifing you, the same as anybody else would. So if your theme is big enough, then you can probably fit a wide variety of different monster types within it. This is also true of locations. You know, this is a game about exploration, at least to some extent. So you want to think of the kinds of places that these people can be found. So maybe this cult are searching for a lost artifact, so you find them in a lot of, like, ruins, but ruins from different cultures, ruins that aren't all the same. But you're going to run across a lot of, you know, archaeology base camps, or maybe you're fighting the queen of an enormous fleet of pirate ships, but, like, each pirate ship that's joined her has a different origin, so they're all different in some way, but they're all, you know, somewhere on there is one of her lieutenants keeping the pirates in line. Maybe you're dealing with a secret cult embedded within an international merchant family, so what you're going to get is a lot of, like, fancy merchant houses with diabolical cult temples in their basements. All of those are good locations, and you want to always think, like, how do I communicate my branding? I mean, I hate that word, but you know what I mean. How do I communicate the identity of this antagonist through things that the PCs can interact with, places they can explore, and items they can use? I mean, it's a cliche to have, like, the cult have face-obscuring uniforms that the PCs can find and put on, but it's a cliche because it's a good adventure game trope. And the same could be true of their magic weapons or their magic communicators or the particular poison that they use or whatever it might be. The currency that the pirate queen found in the ancient shipwreck that, you know, she also discovered the artifact that took over her brain. You know, but when you find someone, even someone who's not part of the pirate fleet tried to kill you, and then when you defeat them, you go through their stuff and you're like, oh, the curse of doubloons again. Interactable objects, whether that's treasure, magic items, locations, whatever, that communicate the identity of the villain. Again, particularly important because for a lot of the time, the villain's going to be off screen. One of the problems of D&D is that it's difficult to have a dramatic boss fight if the PCs know the identity of the villain and can easily get to them. So if you want to have a showdown between the PCs and the villain, it's very hard to, you don't want to railroad it into something where, like, by dramatic logic, a mid-campaign encounter with the villain should be one that the PCs are probably going to lose, so they have to, like, escape. So there you could put in some kind of different mission, right? The goal is not to beat the Lich, but to rescue the prince from the Lich. So we're going to bust into the temple, we're going to grab the prince, and we're going to hightail it out of there before the Lich gets us. You can make that work, but you have to finesse it a little bit to make sure that the PCs don't just try to go toe-to-toe with the Lich and either die, unsatisfying, or kill him, also unsatisfying. Or, you know, you can just scatter the landscape of your campaign with suitable villains and then develop the one that the PCs don't manage to kill on their first encounter. That's also another possibility. Hidden identities work very well for this, so you can actually have multiple encounters with the villain if one of the secrets of the campaign is that you don't know who the villain is. So you know that the sinister Red Scorpion is behind all of these assassinations, but you don't know which of the nobles here in the palace is the Red Scorpion. that can work. And that also gives you the opportunity to have social interaction with the villain, particularly if it's you're in a situation where, like, you can't just go kill the Duke in the ballroom. You know, you have to find some kind of proof, or else you're going to kill the Duke, and then round two is going to be the guards murdering you. So you can have those scenes where the villain and the hero meet in circumstances where they can't necessarily fight, and they can trade, you know, subtexts with each other. Some players like that a lot. Now, when you're developing the group of antagonists that follow a villain, if you've read the role-playing game Knights Black Agents by Kenneth Haidt, he has a thing called the Vampyramid, and I think, I want to say that's developed from another game, maybe from Esoterrorists by Robin Laws, where it's called the Conspiramid. But I could be wrong about that part. And this is when you essentially select, like, the list of elements that you're going to use to make the villain work in your game. So in Knights Black Agents, you have vampires, but you kind of define what vampires mean for any one particular campaign from among a bunch of lists. And then you have lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of different things that could be working for the vampires. So it could be brainwashed humans, it could be zombies, it could be cultists, it could be werewolves, it could be, you know, lesser vampires, it could be Renfield type guys. It could be anything, right? There's so many different possibilities, but you want to have a relatively narrower focus. So you build up this thing, the Conspiramid, which is also kind of how you track down the vampire, right? You sort of work your way up the Conspiramid until you get to the pinnacle. I am a product of my age, and so when I tried to think about this for my old D&D campaign, I based it on Street Fighter. Look, don't judge me. At one point, I knew that the empire that the player characters were exploring in was a bit like the Empire of Warhammer 40,000, in that there was an emperor who was essentially an empty figurehead, and actually all these various generals were really running it. So, at one point, I mentioned that one of the sort of legions of the empire was called the Crimson Buffalo Legion, because red's a good color, buffaloes are strong, powerful animals, and then I thought, you know, buffalo, bison. Okay, the leader of this thing is the Immortal Buffalo General. He dresses all in red. Red Buffalo. That's M. Bison from Street Fighter. And when you have a supervillain, you basically want to, and this is true for, you know, a comic book supervillain as well, although, you know, not always to the same extent. What you probably want is at the bottom, you want to have the kind of troops, right? The legions of the villain. So you want to think, like, who are the ordinary foot soldiers. So for the lich, it might be zombies and skeletons, or it might be, you know, for the devil, it might be cultists, or for the crime boss, you know, it's thugs. And then you kind of escalate to, like, slightly more important ones. And then at the top, you want to kind of have the set of developed characters who are the sidekicks or hench people, the mini bosses, if you will, where when the PCs beat them, they can feel like a sense of accomplishment. So in my game, I had henchmen for the M. Bison character that were based on, you know, Bison's henchmen from the Street Fighter video game series. And there were two different types. I had an elite troop type who were, you know, a themed group of defined characters, but who essentially functioned as a group, who were kind of his elite squad that he would send on troubleshooting missions. And these are obviously based on the dolls in Street Fighter, but it doesn't really matter what, right? The bad guy has an elite enemy, you know, like the Emperor has the Imperial Guard, even though they don't do anything, they look cool in Star Wars. So there's a special troop type. When you see one of these guys turn up, you think, oh, right, you know, now we're in serious business territory. And they also provide an excellent method of escalation. You know, early on, when you're mowing your way through goblins or cultists or ordinary foot soldiers, and one of these elite soldiers turns up, you're thinking, uh-oh, you know, who's this guy with his cool halberd or whatever? And then later on in the campaign, once you've leveled up a bunch, you're able to mow your way through squads of these guys, and then you discover that they have even more powerful leaders and so on, right? If, for example, in the old, well, I guess it's still out at the moment, the Mutant Chronicles tabletop game Warzone, you could use necromutants as squad leaders for the Undead Legion, or you could field squads of necromutants, which were in turn led by a centurion. So you want each layer of your conspiramid to blend with the layers beneath and above it. So I gave the Immortal Buffalo General both an elite squad of agents and four underlings based on, you know, Sagat, Balrog, Vega, and Fong from Street Fighter. And I didn't base their characters on them particularly, maybe Vega a bit. But the others I just kind of went from wherever, you know, Fong's kind of a creepy guy. Shout out to my buddy Jesse Merlin, the voice of Fong from the English language version of Street Fighter V, and an excellent choice for creepy guy voices in anything you need a creepy guy voice for. You know, one of them's the muscle, one of them's the kind of potential rival, and some of them never really got developed, and some of them were just based on puns. So, for example, the one who was based on Balrog from Street Fighter was in fact just a Balrog. I am lazy when it comes to making things up. But individualized henchmen, they make great mini-bosses, they can have agendas that are counter to the main bad guy in a way that, like, reveals the humanity and complexity of the bad guy's organization without having to deal with all the problems that would come from every single goon and minion having their own independent agenda, right? It signifies that complexity without having to replicate it. So another aspect of the successful recurring villain is that they have to change and develop as the PCs do. Now, this could simply be that they change and develop their plans, or it could also be that they become more powerful as the PCs level up, or merely that the PCs learn more and more about them and their organization as they level up. So you could do it either way. For instance, you might start with an encounter with the Pirate Queen where she's just a regular pirate, right? You know, she tries to raid your ship, and then you beat her, and she says, okay, guys, well, look, you know, maybe we can work this out. I misjudged you. You are bold heroes like myself. No hard feelings. Would you like a treasure map? And then the next time you see her, she's acting super weird, and you're like, huh, that's weird. You know, she was very reasonable when we met her. I wonder what happened to her. You know, maybe she found that cursed treasure after all. Although the next time you see her, she's the Pirate Queen of the Thousand Isles in command of a fleet of all kind of scurvy cutthroats. Or, you know, maybe you meet this guy, he's just like a mid-level enforcer for the Thieves Guild, and, you know, he approaches you with a contract, or you catch him, and, you know, he goes to jail or whatever. And the next time you see him, the boss of the Thieves Guild has died, and now he's the capo. And then the next time you see him, his soul to soul to Satan, and he's, you know, amassing infernal powers. So you can do it like that. Alternatively, you can do it as a slow discovery of the conspiracy, right? So maybe you arrive on the outskirts. It doesn't even have to be a conspiracy. Maybe you arrive on the outskirts of the evil kingdom and you start to, you know, see all like that, the outlying villages that are being raided and oppressed. And then as you get closer and closer to the heart of it, you learn more and more of its black secrets. So you can organize that like chronologically, or you can organize it geographically, or you can just organize it in terms of the information that's available to the player characters. The second option, the geographical one or the information one, those are more amenable to sandbox plays. That is to say that you can, you know, when I design a campaign map, a lot of the time what I do is I sketch out a rough area, and then I just put things down on it that are like for inspiration. So one thing that I do is I have a copy of the game Everway. I've never played it, but it has these very beautiful art cards in it. And what I'll do is I'll just kind of like draw a card and slap it down on the map at a certain point. And then I just, whatever that card suggests to me, I make a note of that. So I'm like, there's one Everway card that shows kind of carrion eating birds perched on what looks like the walls of a maze. So I went, okay, fine. The maze of the vultures is here. And it so happens that my characters never went anywhere near the hex that had the Maze of the Vultures in it. Not within 100 miles of it. Okay, cool. Well, no time wasted. I just knew that there was a Maze of the Vultures. So you can start with your pool of, like, inspirational ideas and maybe just, you know, develop the ones that the PCs, you know, if the PCs encounter, like, let's say you've got, I don't know, a plant villain and a bird villain and an ice villain, right? So, I mean, not to say they're Poison Ivy the Penguin and Mr. Freeze, but, you know, that's kind of where you started with it. And they encounter some of the, you know, dryads and hangman trees and so forth that work for the plant villain. But then, then something else attracts their attention. They go over to where the ice villain is. And then they start really getting into the ice villain. You're like, okay, this ice villain's gonna be the main antagonist of this campaign. So now I just have to kind of develop a little further. And the revelation of the villain's power can come as the PCs proceed into the ice villain zone or begin to roll up the ice villain's schemes, that the PCs begin to catch the ice villain's attention. So it's not that this, you know, it's not that this is the main villain of the campaign, except that the PCs have effectively chosen that villain for the campaign. Now, before I go, because I realize that I like villains and I've talked to, I mean, I feel like I've only scratched the surface. I feel like there's so much more I could say. But I want to talk about one of the pitfalls. Sometimes it is possible to, and you can kind of see this happen with Strahd, actually, and certainly with Dracula, that a villain can get softened up by a confusion between, well, not a confusion, a natural blending between an emotion that the players feel and an emotion that the characters feel. In honor of seminal U.S. supernatural adventure TV show Buffy the Vampire Slayer, this is called spikification. But it occurs in lots of other media, lots of other genres. That is, when the viewers like a villain a bunch, there comes a push to make the villain likable, right? Because in an open-ended narrative, if there's a final confrontation with that villain and he's defeated, then he won't be on the show anymore. And we like him, therefore he's got to stay on the show. But if he's going to stay on the show, then we're going to have to either come up with endless contrivances for why neither the hero nor the villain ever actually wins. That's what happens in episodic adventure fiction. So Batman keeps putting the Joker in jail. The Joker keeps getting back out of jail. And fans like to think that they're smart by saying, well, what if the Batman just kill him? Yeah, because you're not supposed to think about the continuity of it, right? If Batman just killed him, yeah, then there wouldn't be any more comic books about the Joker. And we like to read comic books about the Joker. And that was obvious to everyone except the fans who say that kind of thing. Sorry, that's an aside. My point is simply that if the PCs really like a villain, they're excited about seeing that guy again, but ultimately, they're gonna have to defeat the villain in some way. If this happens, you have to take pride in the fact that you created a villain so enjoyable that the PCs were, like, not the PCs, but the players were reluctant to get rid of him. But resist the temptation to turn him into a nice person. I'll put an exception on that. You can do it once. If you've had a couple of mega villains that got taken down and, you know, they fell off the building and disappeared into the fire, or the PCs, you know, jammed the blue jewel right into their evil face and its pure light radiations blasted them to ash, and you've done that once or twice, then, you know, time number three, the villain can turn out to be a friend. If you're doing, like, the gang boss one, then you can have that in the middle of the campaign, right? Where maybe the gang boss is fighting for control of the city, but then, like, demons invade it, and he's got to protect the city. Yeah, great. You can do that and then go back to fighting him. In fact, maybe even during that, the unscrupulous SOB learns some things about you that he can use against you. But in general, if you wind up with a villain who is popular among your players, you're just going to have to make the ultimate power move of having them defeat that villain and hope that your next one's as good. Or have it be the end of the campaign. I don't know. I always feel that my villain like showdowns are unsatisfying, mainly because I'm not as good at designing challenges within the system as I could be, but the players seem to remember them fondly, so what do I know? And I definitely do seem to be able to get the reaction where the players just despise the villains in my games. They're like, oh, I'm going to get this no good so-and-so. So anyway, like, I realize that that is just kind of recurring villain 101. I'd be really interested to hear about the recurring villains in your campaign. So at the end of this episode, you're going to hear about where you can contact me on social media or by email if you want to send me an email, comment on the tweet about this episode, comment on the Patreon site, anything. Let's talk about the specific things that you did to implement recurring villains in your games, or whether you're running those games or whether you're playing those games. I'm really interested to hear about them because I want, you know, I'd love to have a big toolbox of techniques that people can use to put good recurring villains in their fantasy role-playing games. All right, Andy, I hope that you enjoyed this episode. That's about all the villains that we have time for today. In our next episode, we're going to be returning to the S chapter of Monster Manual 2, and we're going to talk about, I think, the biggest power differential we've ever had in the show as we discuss the snake and the solar on Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.